This is Ken Root. Hello and welcome to our weekly radio and podcast, People in the Know. I have a guest on the line, and I thought I'd inflict my opening on him since he was in my seat for much of 50 years. People in the Know is brought to you by a concept by Iowa Hearing. We are committed to helping you hear better. Visit iowahearing.com or call 877-955-4020 for a free hearing screening. If you live in the eastern half of Iowa, you will know the voice of my guest. Sir, good morning.
Well, good morning, Ken. It's great to be with you, but I'm a bit flummoxed by the idea that you've invited me to be on a podcast called People in the Know, because it seems like most of the time when people ask me a question, I have to answer it by saying, I don't know.
If you've heard that voice now and thought, who is that? He is Rich Ballvance, longtime farm news broadcaster and more at WMT Radio based in Cedar Rapids. Rich also has had a career as a commodity broker, and since retirement, he's been actively involved in the Lutheran Church. So, Rich, I'm very glad to talk to you. Where and when did you get started in radio?
Well, the actual very first experience in radio that I had was while I was in college. I was urged by a professor of mine by the name of Jack Shelley to seek out an internship, a brief one, at WHO Radio in Des Moines, because I was enrolled in an agricultural journalism curriculum at Iowa State University, and which is what I eventually got my degree in. And so that was my first exposure, but I had grown up listening to the same people that I very first worked with, guys like Keith Kirkpatrick and Lee Klein, and earlier than that, Herb Plambeck. And so it was that was my first experience, one day a week at WHO while I was in college. I believe that was in my sophomore year. And then I went on to some other part-time and intern jobs at both WMT and at WOI in Ames.
You know, I've always known that you were smart. I could tell that the first meeting I went into of NASB, and I always wondered, you know, how long you'd make it as a farm broadcaster, because you're a little too intelligent to be one of us. But in the course of your time in Iowa, on what I consider one of the great farm radio stations of all times, WMT, you've seen so much change. And the prompting for me to invite you to People in the Know is because you know about at least the last 50 years, because you have been in this business that long, haven't you?
You know, well, that's true. And, you know, Ken, I've been thinking about this the last couple of days since you first contacted me about being on your program. And, sometimes we are have the good fortune of being in the right place at the right time. And when I was in college, I was in the right place at the right time for a career in farm broadcasting, because back in, and many of our farm listeners probably will remember these things, but back in the 1970s, when I first got started, my first full-time job out in Grand Island, Nebraska, began in 1974. We had just experienced in 1973 what was known as the Russian grain robbery. That was when the Soviet Union secretly purchased from major commodity companies in the United States a huge portion of our wheat crop from that year. And it resulted in a huge increase in prices domestically, at least for a brief time. And it ushered in the volatility in commodity markets that has stayed with us through this time. And I was studying then, one of my favorite classes, in fact, was a study of the futures markets when I was in college. And that volatility that sprang up beginning in the 1970s, the early 70s, really was the foundation for what I consider to be the modern farm broadcaster that went from basically reporting on the activities of farm families to a focus that was primarily on farm marketing. And that just fit my interest just 100%. And I think it made it possible for me to have a career that I enjoyed and also made a good living from during that time. And so, you know, I was in college preparing for a broadcast career in agriculture at just the right time, and that worked to my benefit.
You know, Rich, when I talk to you, I realize that you and I are within 2 months of our start date in radio, and that you started and then worked with people that you had listened to growing up. I did the same thing. I don't want it to be about us as of yet and our careers, but I think it should be about what happened during this time that we can, as a first person, describe. And I exactly parallel you in my view of what happened when the Russian grain deal occurred and the volatility that came to agriculture. And for those people who are farming today, this is the base of really where you are right now. Because as I see it, we went through a big supply and small demand of grain from the end of World War II on through the late 1960s. And my parents and others struggled and had a subsidy underneath their grain to get as high as $1.65 a bushel for this wheat. And the corn, soybeans the same way. And then we moved to a change that we were not expecting. And it was such a thrust forward that many people call the 1970s the go-go years because it changed literally everything for people in agriculture. I was in Oklahoma, which was just wheat, so wheat benefited that first year. But Rich, you were in Iowa as you moved on through the 70s, and that was a period when Iowa really stepped forward in its ability to produce. Because the old joke of Earl Butz, who was Secretary of Agriculture, was that he told farmers to plant fence row to fence row. I would tell you that the drill was already in the field, and they were looking to get as close to the fence as they could while they heard him say that. And I wonder your reaction to what happened to farmers when they realized they could make a profit and making more production was the key.
Well, I think that's very true, Ken, because basically we can define the cycles in agriculture based on whatever farm bill was in place at the time or had just recently been put into effect. And so when we got into the mid-70s and especially into the later 70s, we had gone through that quick rush of upward prices. You know, it wasn't until 1974 that we had an average corn price. This is futures prices, but it wasn't until 1974 that corn ever got above $3 a bushel. And then from 1974 on until about 1979, it never came close to reaching $3 a bushel because of the expansion that was taking place. And that led to, some rather devastating consequences, as we know as well. In those years, the disappointment with the fence row to fence row mentality that USDA had and the federal government had presented to the U.S. agriculture community led to some really significant actions by farmers themselves. That's when the American agriculture movement got started. Mm-hmm. Farm protests got started. I shouldn't say got started, but they resumed in the 1970s with tractorcades and that sort of thing. And so all of the euphoria that came with the idea that we could export our way to prosperity in agriculture failed to materialize, and it resulted in some major disappointments for many farmers for several years.
Well, we had a time of volatility, as you pointed out, and we had soybean prices that for a period of time were incredibly high. And all of this, to me, drove farmers to make what appeared to be good decisions in the 1970s. They expanded their acreage. They bid up their price on the crop rent, the cash rent. They brought their children home to farm with them. And all of these things, plus inflation, which I think was a key factor, we had farmers setting in, let's say, 1979 at a place they never dreamed that they would be. But unfortunately, things tilted over badly against agriculture, and the decisions of the 70s made the 1980s, and you witnessed the downtrends at that point. What do you think, in your memories, was most significant about farmers moving from the 70s into the 80s with the changes that occurred?
Well, the first thing it was that basically my memory isn't perfect, but around 1980 to 81, we saw land prices peak for that cycle, along with the not only inflation, but the interest rates. And if you recall, interest rates at that time were climbing rapidly. And by the early 80s, many farmers found that those adjustable rate loans that they had on this land that they had purchased in the late 70s was no longer viable. I mean, in many cases, there was not enough income from farming to pay even the interest on the loans, no less any principal. And so that we saw then again a major shift in the farm program. We went into, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it had involved target prices for grains.
A PIC, payment in kind.
Payment in kind program. And we also had paid storage come into a long-term reserve where mm-hmm. the government would pay farmers to not sell. Mm-hmm. Previously, it was to not plant. Now we're also paying them to not sell. Which led to a huge, huge increase in the reserve supply of grain during those early years of the 1980s. And in fact, by 1984, if my memory is right, for corn, we had a carryover that was virtually equal to the size of the crop. Mm-hmm. We had nearly 100% carryover in corn at that time. Well, all of that. A combination of those things ushered in what we called the farm crisis that lasted from basically about 1983 until we were bailed out of it, really, by the drought of 1988. And that was a tough time.
Let me let you run further, and then we'll go back to our careers during that time. 1988, to me, is the point which the farm crisis of the 1980s basically broke even. It came to a point that you could actually make a profit on your crop that year. And there were people who had already fallen out of agriculture, people who had left on their own, sold out, or people that were foreclosed upon. Land prices had plummeted. And in 88, it seems to me, we entered the current era of agriculture. And moving from there into the 90s, we went through a very different period in the amount of technology that was introduced. The first of the genetically modified soybeans that you could spray with Roundup, changes in plant breeding that were really, really moving fast, and machinery that was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. How do you remember that time?
I think you have to back up just a little bit, because when we talk about the farm crisis years, at that point, the farm programs, the Conservation Reserve Program was probably the key influencer there that came in the 1985 Farm Bill. And it took about 40 million acres of productive land out of production. And if you recall, the real crisis, the next real crisis, was not in farmers, but it was in farm suppliers.
Yep.
We saw various companies going out of business, many machinery companies, local dealerships disappearing across the face of agriculture, and leading up to that, then we saw that the beginning, I guess, 88 also brought about what you would call the beginning of some real concentrated consolidation in agriculture as well. Technology, of course, as you mentioned, did really, really bloom at that time. And I think the key reason for that was, again, the key reason for farmers' adoption of that technology was another farm bill. That was the Freedom to Farm, as we called it, Freedom to Farm Bill, that was passed in 1996. And we had just come off a period of relatively high prices, fairly short term, just a couple of years. And I remember that bill had been passed, and farmers were looking forward to the next spring. And I was asked to speak to a farm group here in Iowa about that. And my caution was to them that you have to expect that prices are going to be lower for a time under Freedom to Farm, because you are also exuberant about planting and producing every bushel you can. And so that, coupled with the technological advances that we had, really, once again, kind of knocked the wind out of the sails of agricultural prices for a few years. And it was the greatest impact on that was on the livestock business. The increase in production of hogs and cattle due to the lower grain prices that we were experiencing in the late 90s, that triggered what we have seen in the consolidation of the swine industry. And so there's always a trigger. There has always been a trigger. And most commonly, it has been a result, the trigger has been a change in farm programs that bring about these swings in commodity prices and changes in the overall look of agriculture.
We have had such volatility beginning in the 70s and on through, and we've had a crushing low and we've had exuberant highs, and what you talked about in the Farm Bill of 1996 and Pat Roberts being able to be the chair of the House Ag Committee. And switching that off of Kika de la Garza, who had been the Democratic chair for years, and turning that bill around into really what was called the Iowa Plan originally, and then became Freedom to Farm, which was going to cut farmers loose literally from everything, was very short-lived in its hopes. And then the fears kicked in when the Asian countries stopped buying as much as they did and went through a period of a trough from that point forward, and the farmers had to go back to Washington and beg for money. But moving into the new century, I'll just stop with one area, and that was Roberts kept saying, we need crop insurance. If we had it to where that farmers have to have skin in the game, we will have farmers who are more responsible in the way that they produce, and they will take advantage of the program. You know, farmers farm the program as much as they farm the land. But, Rich, it seemed to me that crop insurance from the early 2000s forward have taken a lot of the extremes out of agriculture.
I think you're right, Ken. And part of that, of course, is, politicians are very more astute than we give them credit for sometimes. But most of these programs over time always resulted in much larger outlays of federal spending than they were intended to. By the late 90s and early 2000s, it was becoming a realization that that something had to change in terms of how much money was being spent. Today, I guess we aren't concerned about federal spending anymore, but back then they actually were. And the idea that this type of federal support, especially when it was based on on production. And we kept seeing farms getting larger and larger and larger. And an organization called the Environmental Working Group, in fact, has started publishing publicly the amounts that individual farmers were receiving in various types of subsidies. And that that kind of exposure really really pushed the politicians and agriculture itself to try and come up with a different idea. That, and when you referred to the Iowa plan, that actually that Iowa plan was fermented just a few miles down the road from where I live, and a group of farmers who got together and started thinking about how they could do something different. And crop insurance has done that. And today that's not only an integral part of income protection, but it's also helps to drive how farmers market their crops as well, the decisions that they make. So it's removed the government from having as much direct influence on production as it once had, and now is more aimed toward helping farmers to make sure they avoid catastrophes.
Rich Balvans is my guest, and when we come back in a moment, we're going to talk about being agricultural journalists in this period of extreme change in agriculture from the 1970s forward.
Let's take a moment to talk with Taylor Parker, president of Concept by Iowa Hearing. Taylor, I've heard there's a link between hearing loss and dementia. Could you tell me more about the correlation?
That is a great question, Ken, and it's one that has been out there for quite a few years. Johns Hopkins was the first one that Dr. Frank Lynn that kind of made the correlation. We always knew there was something going on with, you know, hearing loss, the brain, and things just weren't you know, adding up. And his research now, he's been doing his research for about over 40 years. What he found is that individuals with an untreated hearing loss, even mild, you are 2 to 5 times more likely to develop dementia. And, you know, most people will say, well, why is that? And it's you know, when you understand how hearing works, it starts to become simple from the standpoint of just understanding it. So our ears conduct sound. And then the sound then gets carried from the middle ear to the cochlea, where the cochlea, there's 15,000 tiny little hairs in the cochlea that now move back and forth that send the signal up to the brain, where the brain processes that information. And when you have a untreated hearing loss, what happens is those hairs in the cochlea will either get broken, bent, or just not move like they used to. Well, what happens then is they're not sending a full signal to the brain. You know, you've been in radio for many, many years. You'll understand this. So imagine, you know, back in the day, we were driving down the road, raining really hard, or, you know, some kind of elements, or we're underneath a bridge, and the radio signal would go out. And you're listening to, you know, Paul Harvey at noon, and you are not quite getting that whole Paul Harvey, and now you're trying to piece it together. You're sitting there, you're leaning forward, you're really trying to get it all to work out. That is your brain all day with an untreated hearing loss. It's trying to piece it together, and it's working harder. Well, what it does is it pulls from two areas. It pulls from cognitive, and it pulls from balance and gait to compensate for that gap because of an untreated hearing loss. The brain then has to work harder. It shrinks, and now we run into a cognitive issue because we've pulled from the cognitive area to help focus on hearing loss. That's where the connection now starts to come in.
Thank you, Taylor. Schedule your free hearing screening at Concept by Iowa Hearing. You could reach them at 877-955-4020 or online at iowahearing.com.
Rich Balvans, I think of you as a farm broadcaster and a really good reporter when you were at WMT. And we outlined earlier all of the things that happened in agriculture, but our job at the time was to report the news and do it in a level that we communicated with our target audience of farmers. I wonder how much weight you felt was on your shoulders during that period, and you can pick whichever one you want to talk about, in getting it to people and getting it right as you put it on the air every day.
There's one experience and that, you know, there's always something that becomes memorable to a very high degree in one's career. And for me, it goes back to the farm crisis years in the 1980s, because it caused those of us, and I know this was true for you as well, it caused those of us who were dealing with a specific audience like farmers to become aware not only of their information needs, but also of their emotional needs and their challenges that they face day to day. And having grown up on a farm, worked on a farm, owned a farm, done all those things myself, it was very, very familiar. And much of the news that we had to report on is negative news for many farmers. You know, farming is only profitable about, if you're lucky, 4 years out of 10. You can hang on for, you know, four more years, and then two years are just terrible. And those two terrible years out of every decade can bring a lot of people to despair. And in the 80s period of the farm crisis, I would say agriculture was in despair. And that I suffered, you know, just being the messenger. Sometimes people want to kill the messenger. And I did have threats against me. As a farm reporter, you wouldn't think so, but when people are that desperate that they're losing potentially a heritage farm that their grandpa had purchased, and those kinds of things, just hearing another day worth of bad news, hearing another bad market report, it's nothing but despair. And so throughout my career, I tried to be not only a reporter, but also one who kind of lived alongside of the farm audience. And as a result, you do things that and say things that hopefully will cheer people up, will give them hope, and also simply give them an ear to their problems. So that's probably the biggest thing of my career that I always tried to focus on, was to live alongside the farm community, even though I was strongly trying to remain objective in the reporting that I did. So that's how I would describe it.
I'm going to go back to a meeting that we had, and you're going to know what I'm bringing up here, to show you that within the ag industry itself and within those people that we were interfacing with in the major agricultural chemical companies, as reporters, we had to take a position of giving the truth to people that were the farmers that we were reporting to. And I recall at one of those meetings, we were in the audience as reporters, and we had other people up front that were authorities on the ag chemicals. You stood up and said something to the effect, "Are these ag chemicals safe?" And it caused a stir, because these ag companies, of which we had an affinity, were not wanting anybody to say anything that questioned their product. And I recall vividly, Rich, a man who, in my presence, says, "We need to shut him up." And I thought, well, you know, if you shut him up, then I'm going to speak, because you're not going to shut us up of doing our job. So are these chemicals safe? And we made them, as all the journalists, address you know, what they were doing and what we were going to tell our farmers. And it didn't come away with their products being banned, but it did come away with the understanding that we had to make a break from being advocacy journalists for everybody who advertised with us and being responsibly good reporters telling the farmers the truth.
Well, I appreciate you remember that. That's one that probably had even slipped my mind, but that was a delicate balancing act, a tightrope to walk, because, as you know, we were farm broadcasters were dependent upon income for our stations and for our management, and you're always dealing with products that are being advertised, and it could become problematic. To become too tightly involved with the advertiser. And I had the experience I remember most had to do with actually a different company that disagreed with a story that I had put on the air on WMT, which was, I will say, 100% accurate, but they did not like it. And it resulted in threats of legal action, and somehow the Des Moines Register got wind of what was going on, and they had a front page story in their farm section back in the 90s about this pressure that was being exerted on me and my radio station by this particular company, because they did not like the story that we had published. But unfortunately, it was, or fortunately for us, it was accurate. But it was not helpful to that company, and as a result, I still have a copy of that newspaper article. But it's hard. It's hard work to remain objective and to ask the hard questions that need to be asked at times, and to remain true to what you and I were taught to be as a journalist, and it was always a challenge, but I liked it as well.
Well, that time we're talking about, because of the extreme changes in radio and other forms of agriculture reporting, is gone. And I hope that it can return. I hope that journalism comes back to being just the facts and taking other areas out of it. I hope that the ownership of media can see that they have a responsibility that they have to live up to their audience. But of course, Rich, the internet age has changed all of this to the point that, you know, we used to be a few who were talking to the many. In agriculture, the many subsided quite a bit, where the claim is that 80% of U.S. agricultural producers could sit in a football stadium today. Even though the USDA says there's over 2 million farmers, and the fact that we have now 1 million podcasters who are all spreading their word without any kind of responsibility. And so here on this podcast, I try to have that responsibility in the same vein as we always did. Rich, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I also understand you have devoted your voice and that incredible mind of yours to your church. What are you doing now?
Well, actually, Ken, I am retired now, but just for brief background, in 1999, I exited the broadcast industry. There were changes that were taking place there that you're familiar with that I did not welcome in the industry, in the broadcast industry, and I basically saw that my role was going to come to an end at some point. So I for about 14 years operated a commodities business, working with farmers in their marketing of corn, soybeans, cattle, hogs, and a few other things, and enjoyed that very much. But in 2013, I had basically made the decision that I was going to work gradually work out of the commodities business and serve Christ, which is something that had pulled at me since I was in junior high school, basically. And I went through seminary, Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, through a special program there, and basically became the associate pastor at my home congregation in Cedar Rapids, King of Kings Lutheran Church, where I served for 10 years, and just recently retired from that. So now I fill in occasionally in the pulpit, but for the most part, I'm a gardener.
Well, Rich, you've had a fabulous career in a most interesting time, and I'm glad we just had a moment to go through those years. I think they're very formative for anybody who's in agriculture. I would wish that some Ag Econ classes at universities could hear you with a combined knowledge of the commodity markets and being an agricultural news broadcaster. We got a bit of it today, and I wish you very well in the future. Hope I get to see you, and I thank you for being on with me.
Well, Ken, it's been a pleasure, and I want to just say as well that Ken was one of the top farm broadcasters in this nation as well, as many people know. And still, I think, if I remember correctly, you and I got the Oscar in Agriculture Award in consecutive years, if I remember correctly. And that was way back in the 70s as well, which recognized good reporting by a farm broadcaster. And that always continued for you as well. And I appreciate your work in agriculture, too.
Well, that's very kind of you. I don't know if you know or not, but the year that I got it, we had a drawing for it. And the year you got it was actually for the merit of your work. I've had three people that I have trained who have won that award. And I'm more proud of that than getting it myself.
Well, I that's completely understandable. That's a great testament to your professionalism, and I thank you for that.
Well, I wish I'd been in Iowa more, but I got here as soon as I could, which was in 2004. And what an experience I had in the center of the universe of row crop production in America. But we've had good times, tough times, changing times. Rich Ballvance, thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to People in the Know. I'm on the hunt for guests to interview. If you have suggestions, contact me at this email address, kenroot@gmail.com, KENROOT @gmail.com. Have a great week.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe.